All right. Hello, everybody, and welcome back to Red Shirts and Runabouts, which is part of the Heroes Podcast Network. With me, as always, and we're back after our well-deserved and fun holiday break. Guys, go ahead and reintroduce yourselves for our fine fans out there. Derek?
Sure. Hi, everybody. I am Derek, also known as the Star Trek Dude. It is good to be back. Happy New Year.
And me, Jeremy, and welcome to the future. We have officially traveled into the future.
And we didn't even have to slingshot around the sun.
Nope.
Now, the year is still young, so we may end up having to do the slingshot maneuver, though. Who knows?
That's true.
But guys, did you were you able to enjoy your break? Get any Star Trek stuff in?
Yeah.
Wow.
I've been sick for a week, so I haven't enjoyed most of it.
I have a cold as well, going on two weeks. I did not really do anything Trek. I just played a ton of video games.
Yeah, me too.
I took a week off, so.
Yeah, video games are always a good distraction, though, especially when you're sick.
Well, yeah. And I had made a goal for myself for 2017 to beat a certain number of video games, and I got it in at the 11th hour, so...
Yeah, there's just you wait 5 minutes and there's more games.
So few games are beatable these days.
Well, that's true. It's a special category, you know. So games like Overwatch or something like that, they don't count,
right.
Which makes it a little bit harder, of course, if I also play those games, which I do. So I had a wide mixture of stuff, but that's not what we're here to talk about.
Nope.
So
no, but we are here to talk about something. Arguably, once upon a time, was as popular in the day as Overwatch is now. Maybe not so much. But for Star Trek fans, universally regarded one of the better of the films, which is Star Trek IV, The Voyage Home.
It was a fun one. It was a little weird, but it was fun.
It's also known as The One with the Whales.
Yeah.
The One with the Whales.
Here there be whales.
And of course, my wife, the marine biologist, this is obviously her... her favorite Star Trek of any Star Trek out there.
So is it fairly accurate when it comes to the whales?
She said, of course, there's always that movie magic.
Uh-huh.
But they got, like, the look right. She had some, as the biologist in her, had some significant problems with keeping humpbacks in captivity. Spoilers.
Well, especially in that pen that they had that was, like, an Olympic-sized swimming pool.
Right. Right.
So she had problems with that, but she liked the look, she liked the feel, she liked the... how they reflected some of the intelligence of the animals. She was like in the sounds.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
So but what we wanted to talk about for everybody out there, you know, we've been doing the movie reviews. We've been talking Star Trek news in general, the Tarantino stuff. We took a break from Discovery because Discovery's on winter break. And Discovery's coming back this Sunday. Is that right?
Yeah. The 7th.
So then we got 7 more episodes, right?
Six. Six more episodes. Six. Yeah.
Well, and during this break, we've been talking movies, news, and such. So today we're going to jump right into The Voyage Home, which, when you're actually watching it, because 2, 3, and 4 are those connected movies, and it picks up almost immediately right after Star Trek III. I mean, they jump, they get the Vulcan and everything.
Right, right.
Which, even if you've never seen Star Trek IV, people have seen bits and pieces, because some of it was replayed in the modern Star Trek with Spock doing all the learning and all the tests.
Mm-hmm.
When the computer's trying to help him rebuild his, his memory.
Right, yeah.
It didn't seem like it was helping as much as it was just testing.
True.
Yes, but how do you feel?
Right. That is an illogical, irrelevant question.
Somehow the computer knows that he's human, or part human.
Oh, yeah. You know, there's another Vulcan out there that told the computer, make sure you ask him a human thing.
Yeah. Get one from me.
So, but before we jump right into the story, we usually open up with, you know, a quick 2-minute blurb. Derek, what do you think of Star Trek IV?
So, I've always loved this movie. I think it's a great end to the sequel, the trilogy that they have between, you know, Wrath of Khan, Search for Spock, and Voyage Home. It's just a fun movie, seeing the characters, you know, out of their element, you know, back in San Francisco in the 80s, and of course, you know, Chekhov with the nuclear vessels, and, you know, of course, there was Cold War tones and that and things of that nature. So I've always loved it. I always thought it was just a ton of fun. Fun fact about The Voyage Home, it is the highest grossing of the non-Kelvin timeline movies.
The highest grossing, really?
Is that like adjusted gross or is that out of all of them?
That's lifetime gross, not adjusted.
Huh. I would have thought so. Like Generations or First Contact would have been higher up.
First Contact was right behind it. Generations did not do that well financially. Mm. So, yeah. So there you go. Yeah, the only three movies to beat it at the box office are the three Kelvin timeline films.
And even the third one?
Yeah, even though there's a steady decline for each of the Kelvin movies, it's still by $49 million beyond beat The Voyage Home.
Well, I guess, yeah, with today's dollars, not 80s dollars.
Right, that's the key. That's the key.
And you know what the sad thing is Beyond is the best of the three new movies. At least, I think so.
I agree with you. Yeah, I think so for sure. Now, if you adjust it for inflation, The Voyage Home actually moves into third place with The Motion Picture at second and the 09 film at number one. So the adjusted price definitely throws everything off.
Yeah.
So.
Well, Jeremy, what'd you think about it?
I liked it. I think I enjoyed Wrath of Khan probably a little bit more just for the kind of classic narrative structure and storytelling that Wrath of Khan has, because it has a villain, it has like a clear arc to the conflict, the consequences feel more severe. This one is more of like a goof around. It's like how with X-Files, they would always say you have like the Monster of the Week episodes and then the core arc episodes. This felt like a Monster of the Week episode where it was just kind of like, all right, what's the point of all this? To just have some whales sing to a tube and then that's it.
And they never really do show where the tube came from, the probe.
Yeah.
Excuse me. It's one of those nice, fun mysteries, I guess.
Yeah, so it's kind of just a pal around goof 'em up movie, which feels like it would be a good episode plot, but it feels like if this is what we're doing for the movie, what's the point?
True. I can see what you mean by that.
It's harsh.
And maybe that's why I like Beyond, though, because Beyond kind of felt like a good episode.
Yeah, like Beyond was their good episode movie. I would say Insurrection was the Next Generation's good episode movie. This is an episode movie, but if you're, I mean, you know, there's no ships. The one ship that they had is Cloak the whole time. There's no sci-fi things happening. The one phaser, like he tried to shoot his phaser and it didn't work. So it's like all of the Star Trek elements are stripped out and it's all character work, which is fine. These are characters we love, but without the sci-fi, what are we doing?
I mean, it's interesting. It's very character-driven for sure. But what's important to kind of keep in mind here is the budget was really tight. They only got $25 million to make the whole movie.
Yeah.
You know, which it didn't even make back in its opening weekend, which is kind of intense. I think that's why it is toned down. They used a lot of real locations instead of having to build sets. There really aren't that many special effects aside from the transporter stuff. That's really about it.
Well, that's it. Kind of felt to me like one of those Legends of Tomorrow episodes where they've clearly like run out of their shooting budget, so everything is just like, oh no, Firestorm can't become Firestorm. Let's hide behind a thing and throw rocks. So it's like it's like everything is kind of an obvious dodge as to why they're not doing anything with, like, you know, oh, we can't afford to keep putting makeup on Nimoy, so let's wrap some terry cloth around his forehead.
No, he had to blend in.
Well, yeah, they had an in-universe explanation. It is kind of like they had to basically do a bottle episode.
Right.
But as a movie.
But San Francisco is the bottle.
Right. You know, modern times is the bottle instead of the ship. So.
And that makes sense, because they had that continuing story arc from 2, 3, and 4. And I don't know if anybody anticipated that this was going to be how they ended that trilogy.
Well, yeah, and I'm surprised to hear that people considered this as a part of that trilogy, because it really has nothing to do, aside from the first 10 minutes, where they're tying everything together and they do the thing that they did in the second movie where they're watching the previous movie on a screen to just kind of do the quick exposition where they're watching the John Larroquette Klingon get blown up from all these different angles that they obviously couldn't have recorded from.
Might as well just kind of start jumping into the story, yeah. Because they start off in Vulcan and we kind of drop the hint. You know, they're trying to help Spock. I don't even know how to describe it because they got his Katra back, but they're basically trying to, for lack of a better term, almost like bring him up to speed.
Well, yeah, they're apprehensive that he doesn't have his memories back, but that never really seems to be much of a conflict. Like, the only thing that he doesn't seem perfectly up to speed on is calling Jim Admiral.
Well, I think the reason is, and they kind of explain it, is that he was brought back in the Vulcan way. And so his human consciousness is kind of buried underneath the Vulcan one now, whereas the Spock we saw before he dies in Wrath of Khan is really the most human Spock that we had at that point. So he's kind of reverted a bit.
So he's on, like, he was reformatted and he's on shop settings?
I mean, kind of, yeah. Right? But he was, you know, he was a dual booting machine, but they really only, you know, they restored the
A drive, but not the B
partition. Yeah, right, exactly, yeah.
Well, yeah, and I mean, that's kind of a big thing with this one is we see everybody get kind of rebooted in their own ways, because we see Bones kind of take the lead doing medical stuff, and we see Uhura getting really into communication stuff, and then we see Kirk get knocked down to captain.
Yeah, I guess at the end of the movie, that's true. I think that's why it's considered a trilogy, is that, you know, it begins right where 3 left off, and it ends Kirk's arc of being an admiral and coming back to being a captain, which is what he really wants.
Yeah.
Right? So it's not even really a punishment. They're doing him a favor.
It's disappointing to hear that the budget was so low, because this was the 20th anniversary of the original series. They could have really blown this up if they had played their cards right, because this is like, you know, 20 years since the launch of Star Trek as a thing.
I still think back in the day, even in the 80s, Paramount almost didn't know what to do with Star Trek.
That's true.
And if you, from a storyline aspect, if you think about Kirk's career, the whole Enterprise crew career, they're ending their whole situation on one hell of a bang. With the massive battle at the Mitara Nebula, then the Genesis planet, and then this. So it's not a bad capstone for Kirk to continue his starship career.
It was kind of like a soft relaunch in a way to get Kirk back in the captain's chair. But then the plans were only to do one more film. I know we got two, but the plans were only for one. So I don't know. It was kind of a weird way to set up a future movie.
Yeah, especially when they, like you said, they were so in flux on, are we going to have one more movie, two more movies, what's going on with people's contracts, is Kirk leaving, is Kirk staying, then does not only Shatner stay, he ends up directing Star Trek V.
Well, and that's actually almost the fault of this movie, because with Nimoy directing 3 and 4, Kirk had his contract changed to basically say, if Nimoy gets to direct, I get to direct.
Yeah.
And so by letting Nimoy direct 4, Shatner got to direct 5, and unfairly gets blamed for a lot of production issues on 5, because its budget was totally slashed. That movie was a mess, and a lot of it's really not Shatner's fault.
Yeah, there was just problems all around. But okay, so they open up, they're on Vulcan, you know, they're giving their ship a nice, very eloquent name. The, you know, the HMS Bounty, which is a great name for a Klingon ship, and any fan of history will know the HMS Bounty and the story behind all that. But they don't waste any time in this movie jumping right into basically the crisis moment. Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of climaxes towards the second half of the film, but the immediate crisis is there from, what, the 10-minute mark?
Well, I mean, the movie starts with the Saratoga outside the neutral zone, getting probed or whatever by the tube.
Yeah, and little footnote, the female captain of the Saratoga is the same actress that goes on to play Geordi LaForge's mother in Star Trek, Next Generation.
And then the admiral we see again is Sisko's dad.
Yep, Brock Peterson, who was also in Star Trek VI.
I was reading some trivia from the commentary, and apparently there was also going to be a kid when they're in San Francisco and they're in front of that big wall that says Yellow Pages. There's going to be a little Japanese kid that comes out that they call Hikaru, and that was supposed to be Sulu's, like, great-great-great-grandfather. but the kid wouldn't stop crying, so they just cut it.
That's probably a good thing.
Yeah.
That's a little too shoehorned, I think.
Yeah.
I mean, it's one thing to use, like, naval ships and kind of throw all that stuff in there. But, yeah, I don't know. Do you really need the... That's what always worried me about the Star Wars prequels was, were they going to try to throw, like, a 7-year-old Han Solo in there somewhere?
Yeah.
And then you're like, oh, really? Was this necessary?
Well, so, but I think what I like about this movie, though, is that the main antagonist is this unknown probe that it really doesn't mean us any harm, but we've actually caused the problem ourselves. And I mean, this was an environmental film, right?
Oh,
this was a, this was about how we are hurting our planet, and one day that's going to come back to bite us. And no, it probably won't be an alien probe that comes looking for an extinct species. Those odds are probably small, but it's an allegory, right? So,
this was the allegory.
Very heavy. It was the WALL-E of the 1980s,
right?
Well, that's a good point, because that was some of the criticism that the Kelvin timeline movies got, where all the characters are just extreme at whatever it is. There's so much loud noises, so much action, so much of this, that, or the other. And even a lot of the modern day critics are like, hey, do you remember when Star Trek used to take a chance on their films, like Star Trek IV, a movie about whales and the environment? And Derek, like you pointed out, it grossed higher overall in comparison than any of the other movies, when you take into account, like, inflation and such, aside from, you know, the Kelvin movies.
Yeah, I think it was really accessible, right? It was PG, but legitimately PG, not like Ghostbusters getting a blowjob from a ghost PG that we had a couple years earlier. Like, legitimately, this is a PG film. The worst thing in the movie is when Kirk says, you know, double dumbass on you. That's, like, the most adult thing in the entire film.
Or
so
Spock gets Tourette's and just says, the hell. What the hell you say? He's
trying to learn how to swear.
Adorable.
Yeah, you know, I guess the guy on the bus does flip off the camera, right? But, you know, anybody could go see this movie. They could take their kids to see this movie. It was kind of a fun film, and it wasn't heavy on the Trek, which meant that if you didn't really know about all of that stuff, if you weren't into the Trekno-babble, that was okay, because you could enjoy this character film.
Yeah. I mean, it was so detached from a normal Trek thing that the Enterprise wasn't even in it until the last 3 seconds.
Yeah, pretty much.
That, and you almost didn't even need to see the other films to watch this one and enjoy it.
Yeah, no, watching it had 2, 3... to do with them.
Yeah, watching 2 and 3 would be super beneficial for people like us, because we love the backstory. But anybody can just watch this and go, this is a good movie.
Except it's not on Hulu anymore. I had to pay for it.
I wish you had told me, man. I own like 4 copies of this movie.
Well, it was on Hulu until like the first. So I kept seeing it in my list of movies, and I was like, all right, when I get around to watching that, it'll be right there. And then, of course, I sat down to watch it 2.5 hours ago.
That's
so
shit.
Yeah, the Saratoga gets hit by that probe, and we're literally like at the 8 or 10 minute mark of the film when stuff starts happening, and because it's the Saratoga that gets their warning out, but the probe made its way to Earth pretty damn fast.
Yeah,
if you think about it, it jumped right from essentially the neutral zone to Earth in, I don't know, 5 minutes of screen time, which is fine. You know, Star Trek's always played fast and loose with the. With travel and warp speed, it's just kind of emphasizing how fast that they jump right into the story. This is one of those movies they really don't waste any time. Every minute of screen time in this film is kind of going towards something.
That's surprising that they didn't stretch out some of those, because they had the Starfleet sets and the shooting locations that they had for Vulcan. So it's like they could have done more with the Trekkier aspects of it, but they did kind of like buzz in and out of those Federation scenes. It was just like everybody gathered around a thing, and then the screens flickered, and then now we gotta go.
Well, I think a lot of that had to do with the characters all essentially work together for the first half of the film, maybe the first act of the film. All the characters have one dedicated mission and goal together, so they're not split off in separate locations, and the other locations have minor characters that are more for exposition than anything else.
That's a good point. A lot of somewhat like secondary side characters that are there for a minute and a half of humor. You know, the antique dealer that buys Kirk's glasses. You know, he's nobody's favorite Star Trek character, but it was neat to have that interaction for a minute and a half.
That was a weird, like, causal time loop, like, very flippantly delivered, where he's just like, oh, but those are the glasses that he gives you. And he's like, yeah, but he's still going to give them to me. So it's like, wait, is he seeding this pair of glasses outside of time?
Yeah, somehow, somebody else is going to end up with them just to give them back, just so McCoy can find them and give them back to Kirk.
So, okay, that's not how I took that line. I've always taken that line as it's a second gift because he's now getting money for them that they can use to complete their mission.
Oh, I thought he was just saying, like, well, if these were destined to end up with me, then these will end up with him, and then they will end up with me again.
Eh, maybe you're both right.
Yeah, maybe. I don't know.
So Kirk and crew, they don't know about the probe at the time. They get Spock, you know, he gets his robe, finishes his test, says goodbye to Sarek, and they get on the HMS Bounty, you know, the Klingon ship. I don't even know if we ever hear the Klingon ship's, I don't remember the Klingon ship's actual name. But they get back on the ship to head towards Earth, and I mean that stuff, the distress signal from Earth and the planet, the Federation president, and ships are getting knocked out all over the place. Remember that the little shuttle, like, and when the probe got close to Earth, and there's a shuttlecraft in the space dock,
and they all turn and off, and float away.
They lose power, so those poor people, I guess, you know, you read books, and the shuttlecraft have like 5 years of supply somehow.
Wait, did he say goodbye to Sarek? Because wasn't Sarek in with the Federation Council burning that Klingon?
He says goodbye to his mom.
Yeah, his mom is there.
Yeah, because Sarek's there at the very end. But man, that stuff, like I keep saying, this stuff just immediately starts happening because they get that distress signal from Earth. And I always laugh. I don't know if you guys remember when they get the distress signal and they figure out what's going on with the whale noises. And they had to talk about attempting to do time travel. And Kirk is, I always laugh because Kirk is doing that. He's doing the message back to Earth. And remember, he's doing all those famous Kirk pauses.
Yeah.
Where it's like, we're going to attempt time travel. And I'm like, Kirk, the people on Earth really don't have time for this. It's like, you need to spit this out, Kirk, so Starfleet knows what the hell you're doing. Because, you know, the probe is ionizing our atmosphere and we won't survive. It's like, damn. This is the
maybe he's assuming it's buffering, so he's trying to give it time so it would link together.
It's like, you know, 2003 YouTube. You got to hit play and let the video just buffer for 5 minutes.
Right.
Awesome. I think they call it time warp, because I remember hearing Kirk say that on the big screen. I'm like, time warp? Like, like, it just didn't seem to fit. You know?
It's just a jump to the left.
Yeah, because even when they brought it up, and even McCoy's like, oh yeah, you fly fast enough and close enough to the star, bam, you're in time warp. Like, so this is like common knowledge?
Yeah.
Like this.
It's like everybody with warp drive can just fling back into whatever time they want. They just choose not to because it's weird.
It's a good thing the Borg never figured this out. We'd be really screwed.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of interesting, right? Because they make it seem so easy. And again, like in First Contact, it's such a big deal that they follow the Borg to the correct place, you know, and like, and they have their own way of performing time travel. But slingshotting around the sun, the Federation was able to do 100 years before.
Well, also, yeah, HMS Bounty seemed to be able to get to warp 10 pretty easily.
Yeah, Klingon ships weren't exactly known for their engines or, you know, speed. That was always like the Federation shtick, right? We have well-built ships that can go fast.
Especially since that ship had just been rebuilt by a bunch of Vulcans wearing weird red fin hats.
Look, they just got done filming Dune, David Lynch's Dune. They had some leftover props. Here you go. This is Paul Muad'Dib's hat that he wore for 3.5 minutes. Yeah. Let's make 1,000 copies of him.
Maybe that's why he was able to go to warp 10, is because he was on spice.
There you go. Now, all it takes is a Vulcan, or even a half-Vulcan, to make some mathematical calculations, and everything can be solved on a old bird of prey.
True. Apple II.
An Apple II.
And you do get the very trippy time warp sequence, where you definitely know it was the 80s, because you're watching this stuff going, We don't have the context or the products that they had back in the 80s. It's a pretty trippy scene.
It is so weird. When I was a kid, I had no idea what the hell was going on in that scene. Where they're, like, coming out of each other's faces, and then the whales show up or whatever. Like, I don't know.
We just got rotoscope. Let's use it. How can we use it? That's crazy. Well, let's do something crazy.
Like, did they all have to think about humpback whales at the, you know, together? is that how it determines what point in time they go back to?
Yes.
You know what? That sounds good enough for me.
I mean, that's science.
I accept Derek's argument, suggestion, and I agree with him.
Chekhov accidentally thinks of the Stay Puffed Marshmallow Man and it all.
Oh, God. That's one hell of a crossover. They go back in time to the Stay Puffed Marshmallow Man. Is there?
It just popped in there.
They think that's what they think this thing can become back. They bring it back.
Did you just watch Ghostbusters? All. That's the second Ghostbusters reference.
Sorry, I love Ghostbusters. It's just in my head right now. Anyway.
So they get back in time, basically. Spoilers, this is where we're getting to the meat of the story. So if you're one of the 0.5% of Star Trek fans who have not seen The Voyage Home, because even Jeremy has seen it now.
Yep.
Stop this recording and go watch Voyage Home. Because it's
I'm
very
a real
entertaining
Star Trek
film.
Fan now, guys. Except I haven't watched any of the original series.
You've always been a Star Trek fan. You were just introduced at a different time. You know,
I'm a Picard.
You still have two. You got two original series movies to go.
I've seen Undiscovered Continent.
Country.
Okay, maybe I should watch it again.
You could hear the bile in Derek's response.
I had to really think about how I wanted to respond to that. We're gonna have you watch it again.
Yeah, you're gonna watch it. We'll watch. Let us know when you watch it because I'll rewatch it again too.
And I will borrow a DVD because.
That's fine. I'll give you the director's cut.
Ooh.
So, yeah. Alright, so yeah, so they land in a park that clearly you can't run through the ship, but nobody goes to this park for like
ever.
The 3 or 4 days or whatever it is.
In San Francisco, an open field park that's never used.
Nobody plays frisbee at all.
But before that, Kirk or Spock had to throw that line out there when they're in orbit. And Spock's like, Admiral, we're probably able to be spotted even by the technology of the day. I always made me laugh. I'm like, if you go back to 86 where we had plenty of satellites, you think NORAD would have been like, what in the hell? Like the moment it just shows up, they're like, what the hell's that? And then it just vanishes.
Yeah.
That's where the UFO stories people come from. It's Klingons ships doing time warp.
Exactly. You
heard it here first. But yeah, the park that nobody uses except the garbage man. But if nobody uses the park, where does all the garbage come from?
Ah. So we're just poking holes all throughout this.
Well, also in Enterprise, don't they say that the Vulcans were already on Earth in, like, the 50s?
Yes, they did retcon first contact with T'Pol's ancestors.
So Vulcans probably would have detected this Klingon warp signature just on Earth.
Oh, that would have been one hell of a story.
Yeah.
Vulcans thinking future Klingons are coming to... anyways, that's a different movie. That's a made-for-TV movie right there. But Derek, you take it off right after they get to the park. I mean,
yeah. So of course, you know, they have to figure out what they're going to do, and so they need the whales. They need a really big fish tank that is conveniently designed inside of the ship.
Well, so before we go too deep into this plan, we have a tube that starts broadcasting whale songs. I kind of missed what the train of thought was that said. We need whales to sing back at them, and that means they'll go away.
Okay, so the line of thought here was that they're listening to the probe.
Yeah.
And Spock is trying to figure out what the probe is supposed to sound like. And then they realize it's pointed at the water. So they ask Uhura if she can modify the signal to make it sound as if we were underwater. And she does the whole fine-tuning thing that she does. And then it makes that sound, and Spock kind of does his eyebrow thing and leaves the room, and he goes to the Klingon Earth animal database that they have, and, right. And maybe they just uploaded it from Vulcan, who knows, but he's going through the sounds that all of the Earth aquatic species make, trying to match the sound that he heard on the bridge.
Yeah.
Until he comes across the humpback whale, which he then knows is now extinct. And he believes his hypothesis is that since the whale is now extinct, and that's the same sound, maybe they're waiting for an answer.
And you gotta love, like you said, that they had the inventory of whales and species either on Vulcan or on the Klingon ship. And
I mean,
Spock was the only one to know that whales were extinct, or humpback whales were extinct.
So the entirety of the plot of this movie is Tube comes to Earth, Tube looks for whales, Spock goes, it wants whales, let's get it some whales. So it's basically a fetch quest for an unnamed, unknown NPC.
Basically, yeah, it would be a side quest, except if they don't complete it, the whole world is destroyed.
Right.
So it's the most important side quest.
Legendary fetch quest.
And if you think about it, whoever created the probe is kind of assholes, because they're trying to find whales, and either the probe doesn't know that there's other life on the planet, or it doesn't care. So
it's like someone in Alpha Centauri is just like, we need to make a tube that checks this planet for whales, and if it returns no, then destroy a planet. It's like, what if the whales are just, like, not there?
What if they're, you know, what if they were all transplanted to a new planet?
Yeah, what if the whales are sleeping that day?
That's the only kind of life that the probe cares about.
So, yeah, so maybe they left themselves open to go back and try to figure out who created that probe. I know there's a whole bunch of theories out there, but anyways... So,
Slingshot back in time to grab a couple of whales.
Yep.
And Slingshot back in time to what Derek was saying about...
Yeah, so they need to get transparent aluminum, which does not exist yet. And actually is super cool because I was reading an article a few months ago that we actually have it now.
Yeah.
We can make transparent aluminum.
It's just like cost prohibitive to make right now.
Right, yeah.
But
how cool is that? How cool is that? That in 1986, Scotty says that we need to make transparent aluminum, and now in 2018, 2017, when I read the article, we can actually do it.
Oh, our cars will be having transparent aluminum windows here in 10
right,
years.
Right, it's pretty cool. But yeah, so they need that, and then they also need, for some reason that I can't remember, they needed like plutonium or something.
Well, they needed to siphon the nuclear energy off of a nuclear reactor to recharge the dilithium crystals.
That's what it was.
Yeah, because Klingon crystals are apparently bad dilithium compared to everybody else's.
No, they just became super strained from the high warp and cracked.
Oh yeah, I just remember Scotty had that line. He's like, it's these damned Klingon crystals.
Mm.
So I was wondering if maybe it's just trying to reference that the Federation does a better job of making engines or something.
Maybe.
But maybe not. Maybe, like you said, they just got really torched flying around the sun at warp 9 point whatever.
Well, Scotty hates being on that ship. I mean, he insults the replicators. He insults the dilithium.
Scotty's kind of a racist.
I've replaced the Klingon food packets. They were giving me a sour stomach.
Good priorities, Scotty.
And then Kirk had his little line, oh, that's what that was.
But it's true though, like Scotty's kind of racist against Klingons, and Kirk is basically the same way by the sixth movie, you know. So
oh yeah,
so just sidebar again for a second here, can you imagine the Klingons from Discovery giving those eloquent Federation conference speeches like they did in this movie? It would be so insane, just like these slavering beasts.
Oh man, that would be interesting, to say the least.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't see that happening.
No.
Have them recite some Shakespeare in the original Klingon.
Yeah. It's like even if we do the mental gymnastics that, oh, this is just what Klingons look like. It's like, yeah, but these greasy, like, alien monsters would never just be like, and this is unacceptable to our people. It's like, no.
The Klingon ambassador, the one everybody loves to hate.
Yeah.
Your vessel did destroy USS Grissom. Do you deny this? We deny nothing.
We deny nothing.
So you admit, and you admit in an open forum you destroyed a Federation ship. And then obviously with all this going on and deciding on the whales, the transparent aluminum, I'll admit I love the scenes where they're starting to interact with San Francisco.
Yeah.
I know some people might complain, they just didn't want to use props or whatever, this, that, or the other. Like, in the modern day today, when people are demanding more realness, less CGI. I'm like, this is like perfect. They actually was part of the story.
And they like improv'd big chunks of it too.
Did they?
Yeah, the scene where Uhura and Chekhov are going nuclear vessels to just people walking down the street. Apparently that was like all improv'd and they were just shooting while extras walked by and they just yelled at extras while that weird mustachioed cop just looked on. Such a strange scene. Oh,
that's fantastic.
But I was reading some of the little trivia and the one that goes, oh, they're in Alameda across the bay. That woman was an extra who wasn't supposed to speak and was only an extra because her car got towed because it was in the way of the production. And she needed to work as an extra to make the money to get her car back.
Oh, wow.
And then she just responded to a question like a normal person, and they had to keep it because it worked with the scene.
That's funny.
Yeah. It worked, and Uhura and Chekhov's response was just as good, too.
So that's what we see. That's what we said.
Alameda, we know that. How do we get there? Chekhov. Although, I guess in the 80s, if a cop did see somebody with a Russian accent asking, where are the nuclear vessels?
Yeah. That's troubling.
They would probably get a little bit more attention to themselves than they wanted.
Also, does Spock speak English, or does he speak Vulcan?
He speaks English.
Okay. I just thought that was a universal translator thing, like he was speaking...
No, Vulcan. he can speak both. I mean, basically Vulcans all know how to speak English, and some Klingons know how to speak English, too. That's why, like, you'll see Klingons go back and forth. Yeah. Right, so like in The Search for Spock, Christopher Lloyd's Klingon speaks English whenever he's talking to Kirk.
True, true, true.
Yeah, that's one of the real inconsistencies in Star Trek is how language is handled. But yeah, so you know they're totally out of their element. You know they have to sell the glasses to get money, and they all get like $13 or something like that.
Which today barely gets you Chipotle.
I know, so. Right?
It's a good thing it was the 80s.
But I think one of my favorite scenes in the whole movie is when Scotty and Bones go to get the transparent aluminum and they have to use the computer and Scotty is trying to talk to it.
He's being so nice to it too. Hello, computer.
And he picks up the mouse because he thinks the mouse is like a microphone that he has to speak into. You know, because Bones just kind of hands it to him all, like, super optimistic about it.
Well, and they gave them an Apple II to work with, and the Apple II is completely mouse-driven because it was the first computer with a mouse, but he does everything by poke typing with just his pointer fingers, and they, like, the movement made it look like he was, you know, super hacker typing, but he was just, like, poke, 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 totally at letter keys in the, like, first and second row, yet somehow he was creating elemental matrices on an Apple IIe.
Well, yeah, I love that because like he just his typing just gets faster and faster as he's going.
Yeah,
and you know it's that old 80s style. Like it's basically what a mechanical keyboard sounds like today.
Enhance.
yes, I love that scene so much.
My favorite scene was when Bones gives that woman a pill that regrows her kidney. That he just happened to have a kidney regrowth pill.
All right. Dialysis, what is this, the Dark Ages?
Yeah. I think that whole sequence was my favorite in the movie, where Bones is just disgusted with society in the 19th century or 20th century. Where he's just like, these people are animals.
It is pretty great when they're trying to smuggle Chekhov out of the hospital, right? And like they're like going through and Chekhov tries to look up and Kirk puts his head down back on the bed. I think that's why I love this movie so much, because I feel like they all had a really good time making it.
Yeah. I mean, there's a lot of love in it. You can definitely see that. And it's definitely made by people who kind of get the jokes and like want to tell these jokes with these characters.
Well, it must have been nice for them to also do a little bit more of a softer film, because Wrath of Khan and Search for Spock are not like peaceful films.
Yeah.
No, they're not. This is a much lighter movie. It's probably the lightest of all the Star Trek movies.
Yeah, you'd hardly know that Kirk's son just died.
Hey-o. Right? Yep.
Yeah, because that doesn't really come up at all.
No. It was like 2 weeks prior.
Yeah, I don't think it's mentioned at all in Star Trek IV. I mean, when Savick is talking to Kirk, there's that scene in the beginning, you know, I want you to know about your son. But otherwise, yeah, they don't bring it up again. I guess they do have to save the world again.
The Klingon ambassador brings it up at the beginning of this one where he says, and Kirk with his son developed this Genesis torpedo. It's like someone in the crowd should have just went like, he didn't know that was his son, and he didn't really care when he died.
That's so sad.
Oh, what a movie. So anyways, the whole slapstick, I'm not using slapstick in a bad way, but the comedic aspects of the film really start kind of taking over because they do, the thing I like is everybody has something to do, and it's not in that cheesy way of, you know, they took a character and they made them the driver. Yeah, it's kind of a heist movie.
Yeah.
And they didn't just take Chekhov and go, all right, Chekhov, your goal for this movie is to drive us to all of these places while we do stuff. It's like they specifically make it so everybody is given a task to accomplish, which, you know, invariably results in Chekhov trying to steal nuclear material from a naval ship, which in the 80s, I guess any time stealing nuclear material from the Navy is a bad idea. but I'm assuming at the tail end of the 80s Cold War heating up again.
Yeah, send the Russian.
Catching somebody that speaks somewhat Russian on an American ship. I don't know. They might have just instantly killed him. I really don't know what they would have done.
Well, I think, yeah, Chekhov is acting so strange about the whole thing that they just didn't really know. Like, yeah, they pointed out, like, maybe there's something wrong with him, right? And they, you know, they have to be kind of careful of that bad publicity.
Yeah, that's true. That's a good point. I mean, they even call him some pretty derogatory terminology that would not be used in a modern film today.
Oh, yeah, they call him the R-word.
Yes, they do. They do. You know, but it's an interesting point because, you know, if the Navy were to, you know, kill a mentally disadvantaged person, that would be very bad press.
This is true. But that's the thing, is that scene, so the stealing of the material leads to Chekhov being captured, which leads to him being injured, which leads to the hospital. It's like, this is one of those movies where, like, everything actually leads to something. Mm-hmm. Whereas there's a lot of modern movies that, Derek, Jeremy, and Greg go get pizza, and that's it. The scene is just us eating pizza. It doesn't lead to anything.
But it still sounds lovely.
Well, it still sounds lovely. I'm not complaining about that, but, you know, if this was Star Trek IV...
Structurally, the movie's very sound because for the heist aspect of it, because everything's not only... Everyone has their role and everybody's assigned based on their skills, but also there's the ticking clock that they introduce because it's like the ship has to stay in cloak, and as long as it's in cloak, it's draining the power reserves. So we have 24 hours to do all this stuff or we'll be exposed and then we're screwed.
Well, and then they also have the clock with the whales because the whales are being moved, right? And then they get moved early, and so the clock gets even tighter. So, yeah, they're constantly on this time pressure, which is something that's really important because in a time travel movie, one of the biggest complaints people tend to have is, well, what's the big rush? They can come back at any point, right? They could come back to, you know, 2 seconds before they left, and it's like not they were never even gone. So they have to create this sense of urgency in the past where they go.
Like when they cut corners and introduce invisible aluminum, and then and Scotty does kind of his lazy causality where he's like, maybe this is the guy who invented it.
I love that line.
In the first Kelvin Star Trek where Spock teaches him how to do it early, where he's like, you were going to invent this anyway with the...
But it's a great line, though, because Bones is like, you know, we're going to, you know, it could mess up the timeline. It's like, how do we know he didn't invent the thing? You know? Scotty's just done with it. He's like, let's just do it and move on.
Yeah.
And the whole time all this is happening, we haven't even really gotten there's so much stuff in this movie, we could spend 4 hours talking about it, the two-hour movie. But we didn't even get a chance to talk about how Kirk and Spock get to go through all of their wacky hijinks of... finding the whales, that's when they sell the glasses to get money to get on the bus, and they meet Jillian, right?
Yeah.
This is after Spock puts out the punk rocker with the Vulcan neck pinch, which was a great scene, by the way.
Fun little note, Jillian is played by Catherine Hicks, who is the mother on Seventh Heaven, and in the motion picture, Commander Deckard is the husband in Seventh Heaven. So there you go.
Everything leads back to Star Trek.
That's true. All roads lead back to the Enterprise.
Lead back to Seventh Heaven.
Anyway.
But yeah, they go to the Cetanarium. What is that place called?
The Cetacean Institute.
Cetacean Institute, which is just the Monterey Bay Aquarium, which it still has the Monterey Bay Aquarium logo, which I guess you only really get if you've been to the Monterey Bay Aquarium, but it's just like they put a big sign under an existing logo.
Basically, yeah.
But man, that video they showed of the whales getting slaughtered, that was shocking. Like, that's kind of hard to watch with modern day sensibilities, because you don't see that anymore. With those billing hooks just like tearing into baleen whale. Ugh.
Yeah, that always really bummed me out, that scene. Super sad.
Yeah, it is, and they kind of put it in there for that little, the shock value while they're educating everybody on what's going on. And it even kind of hits, you know, Spock a little bit. And I know Spock, the human side of his emotions are usually pretty buried. You know, he even makes the comment of, you know, hunting a species to its extinction is not logical. And, you know, I kind of like that. Everybody has their own viewpoints on that. And it's the Vulcan calling the humans out.
Whoever said that the human race is logical.
Yeah. And Shoot fires right back with that. This is, you know.
I love that.
And then, you know, he jumps right into the pool. He doesn't waste any time.
That was hilarious. I was not expecting that at all. He was just hugging that whale.
I love the old ladies. She's like, maybe they're singing to that man.
Yeah, that was pretty good. I also didn't know he was in like little hot pants underneath that robe.
Yeah, yeah. In his skivvies.
Vulcans dress light, right?
Well, they wear one heavy layer and one light layer, so they're always ready to go.
Well, it gets pretty hot on Vulcan, so I guess it makes sense.
Yeah.
So they meet Gillian Hicks, or Gillian Hicks. Yeah, combined. Nice. Why not? I almost said Gillian Anderson. I'm like, from X-Files? Yeah, I got... So anyways, moving forward.
Dr. Gillian, the biggest loser in San Francisco, who doesn't have any friends. Her only friends are two whales that are going to be released.
Right, right.
But she really knows her stuff, so that's kind of cool, right? She's an actual marine scientist, marine biologist.
Whale biologist, yeah.
But anyways, so that's what starts the whole scene with her driving away after they get thrown out of the Cetacean Institute. And then she sees them again and actually offers them a ride. Which, if you think about what Spock just did, that's kind of gutsy of her. She has no idea who these people are.
Yeah, I don't think she has great judgment. She's like very nonplussed when they get on the actual spaceship. She's just like, oh, this is a spaceship. Cool.
She's very excited to go to the future. And she, you know, starts up like a brand new life, leaving literally everything behind.
And she gets a weird little space lapel pin for that last scene.
It's like a Casio watch pin. Yeah.
Yeah.
And, you know, at this point, all the plots are kind of like catching up with each other. Cause you got basically what, almost like four or five different storylines all parallel.
Yeah.
And once the whole Gillian, forget it. She's Gillian Anderson from X-Files. She's the whale. She's the original whale biologist.
Just say Gillian.
Just say Gillian. So all the storylines kind of start meeting up at this point, because that's when they find out her. That's when she finds out the whales are being released. You know, Kirk is able to get her to go to dinner in a very Kirk manner. He doesn't waste any time at all.
Italian.
And, you know, apparently that whole, you know, do you like Italian? Yes, no scene. Apparently that was all improv from Kirk and Spock. They were supposed to just say yes, no at the same time.
Nice.
But the bouncing back and forth was just something they come up with and kept, which, you know, when the director's in the car, you know, I guess you can do that. That kind of helps when the actor is the director.
Yeah. I mean, all that stuff was, like, probably my least favorite part of the movie, with just kind of the Gillian interactions, because there was zero conflict to any of it. They didn't really have to struggle to convince her of anything. She was kind of gung-ho for everything that they told her and everything that they had to do. So it's just kind of like, all right, none of this stuff is consequential. They could have literally stolen two whales out of the ocean and had the same effect.
Yeah, but I like the idea that they didn't have to try and hunt down male and female whales, that they were just right there. Because, like, otherwise, then you have to deal with that, and you have to watch them essentially go whale hunting.
Well, was it, you know? Was it necessary that they had to find, like, a male and a pregnant female?
Well, not necessarily a pregnant female, but I think the idea was to, you know, reignite the species.
Yeah, but you can't do that with a single breeding pair.
I mean, not in real life, but in a movie you can.
Or if they're cloning them in the future, I guess.
There you go.
Yeah, I'm sure they do some sort of gene tinkering. It worked with the, you know, with the augments and cons people, right?
Great. Eugenics whales.
That's yeah, eugenics whales.
I mean, really beefy whales.
Anyways.
Yeah, so, I mean, you're right, though, that the conflict is really kind of taken away because she's just totally on board for everything. She's like, yeah, take my whales, whoever you are, and take me on this weird spaceship to the future, to, you know, 200 years from now. It's going to be great. And then she never shows up ever again.
Yeah. Well, also, does he introduce himself to her as Khan? Does he say his name is Khan? Because when she's outside the cloaked ship, she's yelling Khan.
I think she's yelling Kirk.
I thought she was yelling Admiral Kirk, yeah.
Yeah,
Admiral Kirk. It sounded like Khan to me. It was weird.
I don't know what cut of the movie you were watching, but...
Microsoft $2.99 rental.
Okay.
Might have been some sort of YouTube supercut.
The Ricardo Montalban cut.
Yeah.
Anyways, they get all the stuff, and they kind of throw the climax for a pause for a minute, because after the whole dinner thing and explaining everything going on, and... they get the transparent aluminum, they go back to the ship, and she's like, well, they're going to release the whales. We got to go find them. And Kirk actually stops everything and says, no, I can't go anywhere. The ship's missing. We got a man down.
Yep.
Which was a little almost out of character for Kirk. You know, I mean, Kirk cared about his crew, but that's something you would kind of get from almost Picard. You know, we're not going to leave a man behind.
Yeah, but they couldn't just leave Chekhov in the past.
That would, yeah. And I agree with that, but it's just... it's kind of nice that Kirk put a whole... he put Saving the Earth on hold to go find Chekhov.
Yeah.
Whereas I'm worried in today's filmmaking, they would have found some way to go, well, Chekhov knew what he signed up for, and we're just going to have to leave him here.
True, but also at that point, they were fully powered up and fully equipped, so the time pressure was off at that point. Because if the engines were completely charged, they're kind of good to go. So they could have taken an extra couple days if they needed to chill.
That's a good point. Yeah, because they had to do, but they had to guesstimate the whole returning to Earth thing anyways.
Yeah.
On getting the timing right. But then you get the hospital scene, which is amazing.
Yes, you know, I love that whole sequence. Though, of all of the side plots, it seemed like Sulu's helicopter plot was very, like, we don't need to follow Sulu around that much.
Well, apparently...
yeah, right.
They so you just get a helicopter.
They just gave him a Huey.
Yeah, with $13 that he had. Will this get me a helicopter? Thank you.
He does have his nice moment when he accidentally turns the wiper blades on.
Yeah.
I always enjoy that. But yeah, you're right. Sulu kind of just gets to do his own thing for most of the movie. But, I mean, some of that had to do with the conflict that he and Shatner had. Because by the sixth movie, they're only on set together for the one final scene.
The hospital, you know, they grow that woman's kidney back with, you know, McCoy throwing in his famous one-liners every so often.
Yeah.
You know, what'd you get your degree in? Dentistry? It's like, holy cow, man, you gotta know that this was the technology at the time. I don't know, maybe not.
I want to see, like, a house-style show where it's just bones.
Yes!
God damn it, you barbarians! Get out of my way.
It's modern-day McCoy, or Star Trek 23rd Century McCoy stuck in, like, 1996.
God, I would watch every episode of that a million times.
He accidentally gets left behind and has to make a living as a doctor.
Just like Dr. House, who knows everything but also has scientific advances that he can't share with society.
Damn it, Jim, it's never lupus.
Damn it, Jim, I have a vial of the cure for lupus, but I can't let it get into the time stream.
All right, we'll have to do a separate episode on McCoy gets stuck in the past.
All right.
Because they wrap things up pretty cleanly and pretty nicely. Obviously, they save Chekhov because they beam him right out of the elevator and they go find the whales. Which again has another great meme-worthy scene when Michael or Jillian gives the code, the radio frequency to Kirk, and they find the whales. And there's a, it's a Finnish whaler or is it an Icelandic whaler? It doesn't matter, I guess.
It's Finnish.
But there's that whaler that's trying to hunt down the two whales, and the harpoon is fired and stops in midair because it smacks the vertebrae.
Bonk.
And of course, you have to decloak just to intimidate him, right?
Oh, see, I thought the harpoon broke the cloak. I was like, they need to take that into the future. Just shoot harpoons.
Just make harpoon minefields.
Yeah. That's all it takes. Cold iron. Just breaks that.
A harpoon fired from a whaler. I love it.
Fantastic.
I always kind of put myself in that captain's shoes when you're on the whaling boat. Like, what do you even do? Just turn the wheel as fast as you can. But things get wrapped up pretty nicely. Obviously, you know, they get back to Earth. They're able to time warp back. And what's the line with Spock when he's talking to Kirk? And he's like, I couldn't remember everything, so I guessed.
And he's, that's wonderful, Spock.
Good job.
He's a gold star. Spock's
all worried. He's like, what? This is, I feel better about your guess than most people's facts. It's like, ouch.
It's a good line, though. I like it.
It's a great line.
Bones and Spock have a weird relationship in this movie. There's like three different times where Bones is kind of like all up in Spock's business. And he's like, hey guy, how's it going? Let's let's have a little powwow. Spock's just like, I'm fine. Just back up.
What's death like?
Yeah.
Oh, I can't discuss it without a proper frame of reference. You mean I have to die to discuss your thoughts on death? Anyways, they wrap everything up pretty nicely. Obviously, make it back to the regular 23rd century. The whales save Earth.
I will say the shot when the Klingon bird of prey and the storm goes under the Golden Gate Bridge is pretty sweet.
Yeah, they had a lot of good flight sequences, like with the ships flying around. It was cool.
And that was a model, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
That was a pretty awesome scene.
That was pretty great. I love that shot.
And it still holds up pretty well. I mean, yeah, you can see the miniature stuff, but it still holds up surprisingly well 31 years later.
Yeah.
Compared to all the CGI, you know, nonsense out there.
Absolutely.
True.
And then they have the big trial, and Kirk is slapped on the wrist by getting everything he's always wanted.
Yeah. The demotion he's dreamed of.
And Jillian is very excited for him, so I guess they had a long talk about everything, you know, but she never shows up again. I really thought that maybe she'd become a more stable love interest.
Oh, like if they would have brought her back for 5 or 6?
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
Even in a throwback, have her photo on a frame in his cabin or something like that. That would have been kind of neat.
There's another show, too, just The Adventures of Jillian Stuck in the Future.
There we go. And then the
whale biologist in a world with no whales.
I like it.
They got three now, right? The eugenics whale program is started by her. She's like, don't worry, my minions, we'll have revenge.
That's the stealth prequel for Street Sharks.
Ooh, I like it. I like it.
There we go.
But then, of course, we see the Enterprise A and all of its glory as they pan over the Excelsior, and everybody's faces get all excited.
And Scotty hates the Excelsior.
Aye, and if my grandmother had wheels, she'd be a wagon.
Yeah.
He really hates the Excelsior.
Didn't he, like, do most of the engineering work for it?
he hates that ship, though. And Sulu loves it, which I thought was great foreshadowing, since he ends up being the captain.
Yeah.
Spoilers.
Nah. Look, he's had it in a movie and he's had it in an episode of Voyager. So at this point, you know, I'm sorry if that's a spoiler and you're really upset. You can yell at me on Twitter.
Don't worry, I'm sure somebody will. But they get the Enterprise A, which whenever we end up talking about Final Frontier, Jeremy, I'm not going to spoil anything. Just remember, at the end of Star Trek IV, The Voyage Home, the Enterprise is working perfectly.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, that's important to remember.
I mean,
it is a brand new ship, top of the line, Constitution class, Enterprise A, in mint condition.
Also, At what point did they build that thing?
On Tuesday.
Oh, so they're just cranking out new flagships of the...
Well, after DS9 came out, and remember that Defiant was... Spoilers, the Defiance destroyed Deep Space Nine, and they get a new one. But it wasn't the new Defiant. It was another Defiant-class ship with a different name, and they just renamed it to Defiant. Right. So I'm wondering if they did something like that with one of these.
They might have just done a rechristening, but it is a different ship, and the design is different.
Oh, yeah.
Because by the time you see it, it's a redress of the Enterprise D set.
Yep. Yes, so, it is.
Yeah. But I mean, that's the movie, and that's our time. We're over the hour mark here.
Yep.
So, final 5-second thoughts. Derek, love or hate?
Love it. Love it.
Jeremy, love, hate, or indifferent?
Somewhere between indifferent and love. I liked it. It just didn't blow me away.
You liked it, you just didn't like it?
I wouldn't put a ring on it.
Greg, what about you?
I love it. It's... Top two or top three of all the Star Trek films. 2, 4, and 6 always keep changing places depending on which one I'm watching.
Of all Star Trek films or just original series films?
For me, pretty much all of the films.
Damn.
Yeah, see, 2, 4, 6, First Contact, and Beyond are my tops. Not necessarily in that order, by the way.
Yeah, I'm with you, Derek.
I'm all about Insurrection. It's my 1, 2, and 3.
It's all three. It's your whole top three.
Yep.
Saddle up, lock and load.
Yeah.
On that note,
should we all sing British Tar?
No spoilers.
All right.
Oh,
well,
man. All right. We'll get to that one.
We'll get to that one. Well, we're going to wrap up the show then.
So, next week is Discovery.
Discovery comes back.
Yeah.
So. Gentlemen, before we close out, Derek, how can people find you if they want to talk to you?
I am the Star Trek Dude on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. Please come talk to me. I'm also on a couple other shows on the network, including Screen Heroes, our TV and movie show, which streams live on Tuesday nights on Twitch, twitch.tv/heroespodcast. And I'm also on Gamer Heroes, our video game podcast that has new episodes every week as well.
And I am Zen Munkin on Twitter, and I am on another show on the network called the Saturday Morning Tooncast, which comes out on Saturday mornings, and we talk about cartoons.
And sugary breakfast cereal.
And sugary breakfast cereal, yes.
Sugary breakfast cereal, I love it.
Next episode's going to be Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles.
Amazing. Yep. Then we got to do He-Man. Anyways, you all can find me out there on Yahoo and Twitter at @the_bittersteel. Which, weirdly enough, I actually got a comment on Twitter about where the name came from. It's Game of Thrones.
Oh, yeah?
Half my stuff is either Game of Thrones or Star Trek. Maybe a third is Star Wars. I got to keep working on my ratios. But anyways, everybody, appreciate you listening. We'll be back again next week for Discovery returning on Sunday. Thank you so much for listening to Red Shirts and Runabouts, which is part of the Heroes Podcast Network. Give us a like. Find us on Facebook, Twitter.
Subscribe on iTunes.
Subscribe on iTunes or Google Play. I use a new podcast app. It works great on my iPhone, so check it out, everybody. And thanks for listening. Red Shirts and Runabouts is part of the Heroes Podcast Network. The show is hosted by myself, Gregory Bosco, along with Jeremy Munkin and Derek Mayer. The theme song is by Flying Killer Robots. You can find us, as well as other Heroes Podcast Network shows, at heroespodcast.com. as well as on iTunes, Blog Talk Radio, Google Play, and anywhere you can use an RSS feed. Follow us on social media at Heroes Podcast on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, and Twitch. And you can also email us at contact@heroespodcast.com. Engage.